You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello and welcome to Denver Metro News, read by Matt. Our top headlines today, this week, are Colorado AG Weiser pitches streamlined permitting renter protections in affordable housing plan. Colorado budget writers question governor over proposed Medicaid funding levels. And appreciating art beyond sight at the Shared Visions exhibit. Plus miscellaneous articles. We begin with the Denver Herald Dispatch, week of November 20th, 2025. Colorado AG Weiser pitches streamlined permitting, renter protections, and affordable housing plan. Accompanying photograph is a man in a cold weather attire on the steps of the Capitol building. He's surrounded by people also dressed for cold weather. They're holding signs, envelopes, and there's a PA system behind him. Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser walks down the steps of the Colorado Capitol at the hands-off rally and march opposing President Donald Trump's administration on April 5, 2025. In Denver, the protest was one of over 1,000 planned across the country. Article by Lindsay Toomer, Colorado Newsline. Colorado should aim to add 40,000 attainable owner-occupied homes and decrease costs for 100,000 renters by 2035, Attorney General Phil Weiser said November 13th. As his campaign for governor rolled out a housing platform, he said would cater to the needs of all Coloradans. I want Coloradans to know that I'm confronting this challenge with a sense of urgency, seriousness, and creativity, bringing bold leadership that will focus on this problem. Weiser told Newsline in an interview, whoever you are, a renter, you own your home, you live in the urban areas, rural areas, our platform is comprehensive and addresses across the board. I'm the only candidate who can say that. Weiser's proposed policies to increase housing stock and affordability in Colorado include speeding up construction, permitting processes, streamlining government housing programs, supporting first-time homebuyers, and preserving existing affordable housing units for renters. When I talk to Coloradans, affordability, particularly with regard to housing, is often the first topic on their mind, Weiser said. It's particularly a concern for key professionals like teachers, law enforcement officers, and nurses who are having a harder time affording to live in communities where they work. If elected, Weiser would appoint a cabinet-level chief housing officer and create a state housing innovation team that would coordinate all state housing efforts. Currently, multiple state agencies work on housing policy, which Weiser said makes it not always as coordinated or as focused. For a large priority like housing, Weiser said it's important to have a point person to lead and help drive the sorts of outcomes we want. A housing innovation team would look for solutions that have worked in other cities and states and determine if any could work in Colorado. An example of that work could include looking at buildings school districts no longer use as an opportunity for employee housing. He also said that legislation to lower permitting fees for affordable housing projects, which are currently the same as fees for multi-million dollar homes, could incentivize more affordable construction. He also wants to work against corporate landlord abuses, including junk fees and rent-setting algorithms, which he challenged as Attorney General. The Colorado legislature passed a bill banning the practice, but Colorado Governor Jared Polis vetoed it. Weiser said he would have signed the bill into law, adding that his track record and expertise as Attorney General show a demonstrated commitment to standing up for consumers. And he'd aim to continue that work as governor in collaboration with the next Attorney General. Weiser is running against U.S. Senator Michael Bennet for the Democratic nomination for Colorado governor. Bennet announced his housing platform in September. Whoever wins the Democratic primary in June 2026 will likely be favored to win the general election. Colorado hasn't had a Republican governor since Governor Bill Owens left office after the 2006 election. Most of the state's housing funds come from Proposition 123, a measure Colorado voters approved in 2022, that dedicates an additional $300 million annually to the state's affordable housing efforts. It protects the additional revenue by exempting the funds from the annual limits, set by the Taxpayers' Bill of Rights. The 1992 state constitutional amendment that places restrictions on Colorado's tax and spending levels. The Colorado legislature in recent years has passed several laws reforming land use policies in the state to encourage additional housing construction. That includes laws to streamline modular and manufactured housing, expand the parts of the state where accessory dwelling units are universally allowed, incentivize denser housing around transit hubs, and reduce litigation risks for construction defect claims. Colorado Governor Jared Polis has made more housing now a key goal throughout his second term as governor. Demographers estimate Colorado needs about 100,000 more units to meet the housing demand in the state. This story is from Colorado Newsline, used by permission. For more and to support the news organization, visit coloradonewsline.com. Colorado budget writers question governor over proposed Medicaid funding levels. By Sarah Wilson, Colorado Newsline. Colorado state lawmakers in charge of writing the state's budget questioned Governor Jared Polis' proposal to fund Medicaid less than its projected growth over the upcoming fiscal year. The Medicaid cuts here are particularly large, given the scope of Medicaid in our budget. It's not an unreasonable approach, Senator Jeff Brides, a Greenwood Village Democrat, said during Polis' presentation of his budget proposal to the Joint Budget Committee on Wednesday. It is concerning to see, and I want to know what you've done to ensure that these reductions are targeted and minimize impact on accessibility in the state. Polis said he does not characterize his plan as cutting Medicaid, but as a reduction in how fast the program for low-income Coloradans grows. The program is projected to grow nearly 12% next fiscal year, which begins in July, which would require a budget increase of about $630 million. Instead, he wants the legislature to approve a budget that would only allow Medicaid spending to grow by about $300 million. This isn't a trim, said Senator Barbara Kirkmeyer, a Brighton Republican. It's a blow to families who are already fighting to get care. These numbers represent real people. Medicaid is responsible for more and more of the budget each year, now up to about one-third. The state's spending power is constrained by the growth of inflation and population due to the taxpayers' Bill of Rights, so ballooning Medicaid costs have forced budget writers to cut other program spending. We want any item that grows faster than other items to be one you look at with a magnifying glass and demand better outcomes and better results, Polis said. Rep. Kyle Brown, a Louisville Democrat, suggested that the state needs to take steps to right-size Medicaid utilization so clients are getting care, quote, at the right place, at the right time, and at the right level of care. Medicaid costs are determined by utilization and provider rates. And Polis recently signed an executive order to reverse a provider rate increase to address a budget shortfall. What we end up doing, for the most part, is not actually attacking utilization, but attacking the rates at which we pay providers, Brown said. Polis and Mark Ferrandino, the director of the Governor's Office of State Planning and Budgeting, said an anticipated analysis on Colorado's Medicaid program from a third-party firm will give insight into how the state compares nationally and what policy changes could be helpful long-term. The Joint Budget Committee is in charge of writing the state's annual budget, which is constitutionally required to be balanced. The governor submits an initial proposal in November and another in January. The legislature typically debates and votes on the budget in March. The state is also preparing to implement new Medicaid eligibility work requirements by 2027, which Ferrandino said could cost upwards of $5 million. That could get us a good start to get it implemented, but we are waiting on the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to give us that guidance, he said. That could change significantly what the requirements would be. This story is from Colorado Newsline, used by permission. For more and to support the news organization, visit coloradonewsline.com. Appreciating art beyond sight at the Shared Visions exhibition. Arapahoe Community College and the Colorado Center for the Blind present their 11th multisensory art show. Accompanying photographs shows a large artwork, looks like knitting, made of fabric, many designs, kind of shaped in amoeba patterns. kind of an oblong quilt, but with jagged edges, and looks like colorful patches sewn together. Sarah Torres's crocheted wall piece was inspired by bacterium and mold. The next image shows three display tables. There is a ceramic turtle, what looks like black ceramic bowls, and other clay or ceramic vases and containers on display. In the background, more art hang on walls. From a far away, they look kind of like masks. Clay sculptures of a variety of textures are displayed at the Shared Visions exhibition in Arapahoe Community College. Article by Isabel Guzman. I. Guzman at coloradocommunitymedia.com. In art museums, visitors can view the artwork, taking in their complexities and interpretations from a distance. Stepping past the taped lines on the floor is forbidden. Much less is touching the art allowed. Yet the rules are being challenged at Arapahoe Community College's Shared Visions exhibition in partnership with the Colorado Center for the Blind, running until December 3rd, with the gallery being closed for Thanksgiving from November 24 to 30. The exhibit invites visitors to engage through touch, sound, taste, and smell. The gallery showcases a brightly knitted wall piece, bumpy half-baked clay cups, music, jelly bean tasting, and a walk-in simulation of a night in the mountains in New York, to name a few. A show beyond sight. Both students from ACC and CCB contribute to the gallery. This year's exhibition, in its 11th year, features works from about 30 ACC art students and about 10 CCB artists. I think the thing I get from my students a lot of times is, "Oh, I never thought about that," said Nathan Abels, an art instructor at the college who also coordinates the Shared Visions exhibition. 11 years ago, Abels and his close friend Ann Cunningham, who is an art teacher at CCB, decided to curate an art show that goes beyond seeing. In the first year, one of Abel's students fixed cotton behind an image of a tree branch. The student then said that once the canvas was touched, an image of the northern lights could be felt, illustrating the different perspectives based on the senses being used to interpret the piece. It's a way that the students are relating to another person's experience, empathizing with a different way of experiencing the world. And I think that, in and of itself, is a valuable, Abel said. Experimenting with taste and emotion. While most artists stuck with catering to the sense of touch, one of the students this year took on the challenge of creating a piece where taste can interact with the art. "Taste is very meaningful to me," said Patty Palko, an art student of Abel's. When a doctor suggested Palko follow an elimination diet or a system of avoiding certain foods to understand her food allergies, she realized how food can connect with more than hunger, with emotions, socializing, or fulfilling a craving. Drawing inspiration from her garden, Palko crafted edible pieces representing the four seasons: the impatience of winter, the excitement of spring, the satisfaction of summer, and the bittersweetness of fall, using food and or drink for each, she said. For her winter creation, Palko made a shot glass out of ice, which contained cocoa-dusted Rice Krispies topped with mint. It captured the bitter cold of winter, its icy crunch, and the refreshing sting of mint, she said. For the summer, Palko arranged fresh honey with bee-shaped fondant pieces, with a bit of ground coffee to showcase the pests of having a summer garden. "It took a lot of experimentation to create a taste to convey my emotions around each season," Palko said. Different ways of seeing. The theme of artists losing their senses is a recurring one throughout history, from Claude Monet, who experienced vision loss due to cataracts, and Beethoven, who became deaf at the peak of his career, to contemporary Turkish painter Eref Arman, who has been blind all his life. "We all experience the world differently," Palko said. "Even something as common as the Denver Broncos' color blue looks different depending on who is seeing it." Palko said that considering multiple perspectives is the key to creating art that can be enjoyed by people of all abilities. I need to hear other people talk about art. I need to understand the conversation artists are having with the public through their pieces. I need to try to experience the world the way that other people do, she said. To me, accessible art includes diverse senses and perspectives, so everyone has a way in. For CCB's Dan Burke, who has come to each Shared Visions exhibition for the past decade, blind people feel the need to express themselves just as sighted people do. It's just a matter of creating that opportunity for them, because many feel that blindness prevents them from creating art, he said. The excitement of each exhibition, where people, both blind and sighted, can enjoy the art, never diminishes, Burke said. In the late 1990s, the CCB launched its art program when executive director Julie Dedden collaborated with Cunningham. Their goal was to explore the potential of providing art instruction to blind people. Cunningham said, "We kept testing, trying to find the boundary of what blind people could do with art, and we haven't found it yet." Burke said the Shared Visions exhibition is a community asset that CCB always looks forward to attending. "It is a highlight of our year to see this exhibit, to go to the reception and to talk with ACC students, and for our student work to be seen as well," he said. When asked what Abel's hopes exhibition patrons leave with, he said, "I hope that they have this feeling that art is accessible and that anyone can make it and anyone can experience that." The following page contains an advertisement for Denver General Plumbing, Heating, and Air. Fair price, longer warranty, licensed master plumber, master mechanical. HVAC repairs, boilers, furnaces, AC, plumbing repairs, gas leak repairs. 10% military and senior discount. Call Denver General Plumbing, Heating, Air, 303-955-5100. Or email Garrett, G-A-R-R-E-T-T, at denvergeneral.net. Legislative leaders to vote on permanent video live streaming of committee meetings. Accompanying photograph shows three people, an African-American man and two women, sitting behind a dais or a government bench. Colorado Senate President James Coleman left, House Speaker Julie McCluskey center, and House Majority Leader Monica Duran right speak to governor's office analysts during a meeting of the Executive Committee of the Legislative Council on July 30th, 2025, at the Colorado Capitol in Denver. Article by Sarah Wilson, Colorado Newsline. Colorado legislative leaders will soon vote on whether to extend or make permanent a system to live stream video of committee hearings at the Capitol. The Executive Committee of the Legislative Council, made up of party leaders in both chambers, approved a pilot program earlier this year for video streaming in five committee rooms. Previously, only audio was live streamed and archived for committee hearings, making Colorado an outlier among state legislatures. Since then, people access committee video live streams over 15,000 times during 35 meetings between July 30th and November 5th, according to a report from Legislative Council staff. About 60% of those views were related to the planning proceedings and aftermath of the special legislative session in August. The most viewed meeting was an economic forecast to the Joint Budget Committee on September 22nd. A major change during the process of the pilot project was that users can now see live slide presentations, LCS Director Natalie Castle told lawmakers on Friday morning. "That was one of the things we heard from people that they were really happy to be able to see. The video stream shows the same view as a committee participant on Zoom with a fixed wide shot on the committee room dais. Remote participants and any materials being presented." The pilot program has been extended until the end of the year. Video can make it easier for people to follow committee testimonies as well, as statements made by committee members, especially when speakers aren't identified, reads a letter of support from the Colorado Freedom of Information Coalition and other organizations to Legislative Council. Video provides context, allowing observers to see who is present and to gauge the emotions and reactions of lawmakers and others in the room. When people can watch the legislative process, they can better understand the legislative process, and that can foster more civic engagement. The Colorado General Assembly is currently the only state legislature in the country that does not provide video of committee hearings, according to a document shared earlier this year by the CFOIC. The executive committee will vote on whether to make video streaming permanent at their next meeting. It would cost $20,000 to set up and then $50,000 per year, primarily for storage costs. I want to voice my enthusiastic support of continuing and expanding what we have already done, House Speaker Julie McCluskey, a Dillon Democrat, said. I have had conversations and really appreciate the overall perceived value that this has brought to our public. This story is from Colorado Newsline, used by permission. For more, and to support the news organization, visit coloradonewsline.com. The following is an advertisement for the Denver Concert Band presents Heroes and Holidays, Sunday, November 23rd at 2 p.m., Lone Tree Arts Center. Lone Tree Arts Center, 10075 Common Street, Box Office 720-509-1000, denverconcertband.org. Depot Art Gallery offers unique handmade gifts for Christmas. This year marks the 44th annual Holiday Boutique. Accompanying photograph number one shows a table full of crafts. There are little snowmen ornaments for Christmas trees and what looks like coasters with scenes of leaves or fields or wagons and flowers or houses painted on them. Snowmen Ornaments and Coasters by Tippy McIntosh. The second picture shows more crafts. These ones are Christmas trees, very small bits of wood, which is the trunk of the Christmas tree. And on top of them is fabric triangles of different patterns and designs. One is an elf with a beard and a pointy hat. I believe they're actually fused glass sculptures by Sally Vandekamp, not fabric. And a hand-painted vase by Chris Schrank is the last photo. It's a beautiful blue vase, and next to it are holly and a pine cone sitting on a table. Article by Isabel Guzman, iGuzman at coloradocommunitymedia.com. Each holiday season, the historic Depot Art Gallery in downtown Littleton transforms into a cheerful showcase of creativity and craftsmanship. In 1981, artists from the Littleton Fine Arts Guild decided to host their first holiday boutique in the gallery space, featuring handmade items that reflect both the spirit of the season and the talents of local artists. The idea caught on quickly, becoming an annual event for Littleton residents looking to give locally made gifts with a personal touch. This year marks another milestone for the boutique, with 43 guild artists participating and each bringing as many as 30 unique items to their displays, meaning visitors can browse nearly 1,000 pieces of art and handcrafted goods, ranging from original paintings to whimsical Christmas decor. Among the most purchased items at the boutique are handmade ornaments, gnomes, and small stained glass Christmas trees. In addition to larger wall art and sculptures, the boutique offers smaller treasures like magnets, jewelry, and hand-knitted scarves, hats, and gloves. Participating artists and organizer Judy Strickland said that the variety of materials and techniques on display showcases the depth of talent in the guild. One artist used all the flowers in her garden to make her dyes, so it's all natural, she said. The boutique opened October 28th and runs through December 28th, giving shoppers 2 full months to find something truly distinctive before the holidays. Since opening, Strickland said she's already seen moments that remind her why the event remains such an important part of the community's traditions. A lady came in just the other day and she purchased a handmade clay flying dragon, and it was probably about 10 inches long, she said. For Strickland, that's what makes the Depot's Holiday Boutique special. Each gift is one of a kind, crafted by real talented hands, not mass-produced in a factory. The boutique is very high-end, with well-done, handmade items. It's not just a craft show, she said. Each year, the gallery sells roughly 300 to 500 items, with pieces that range from affordable trinkets to more elaborate artworks. Many of the smaller items, like miniature prints and handmade cards, are priced at just a few dollars, making them perfect stocking stuffers or small tokens of appreciation. New this season is an expanded selection that reflects more holiday traditions. The boutique now includes handcrafted items celebrating Hanukkah, such as paintings, holiday cards, and gift bags featuring menorah designs, marking the first time the Fine Arts Guild has offered pieces representing the Jewish holiday. While Littleton residents make up the majority of visitors, Strickland said the gallery often sees travelers from across Colorado and even out of state. Tourists browsing Main Street's shops often wander into the depot looking for a keepsake that can fit in a suitcase. That really makes you feel good when you've got local people and visitors supporting the local artists, she said. Housed in a historic 1888 train depot that once served the Santa Fe Railway, the Depot Art Gallery is itself a piece of Littleton's story. The blend of history, art, and community lends the holiday boutique a sense of warmth and celebration that regulars have come to cherish each winter. The Depot Art Gallery is open from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Tuesday through Sunday and will be closed on Thanksgiving, Christmas Eve, and Christmas Day. Visitors can find it at 2069 West Powers Avenue, just steps from downtown's holiday decorations and festive lights, a fitting home for one of Littleton's longest-running holiday traditions. The following is an advertisement for Reverse Mortgages Made Easy. Call me to schedule your free confidential in-home review of this unique product. Mike Bruja, Reverse Mortgage Specialist. Cell 720-435-0653 or mike@rmofco.com. Reverse Mortgages of Colorado, rmofco.com, helping those in my community with their mortgage needs for over 36 years. Strong defense propels number 3 Vista to 5A football quarterfinals. Golden Eagles hold number 14 Eagle Crest to 119 yards of total offense and 14-0 win. Photograph shows a very action-packed play in football. One man laying face down on the ground while another man jumps over him. I think he's holding the football, and several people of other from both teams, both in white uniforms and green uniforms, running into the background. Mountain Vista's Dylan Dunbar, number 4, is tackled by Eagle Crest's Cameron Bell, number 6, in a Class 5A second-round game on November 14th at Highlands Ranch Stadium. Vista won 14-0 to advance to the quarterfinals. By Alex K.W. Schultz, special to Colorado Community Media. The Mountain Vista football team, under coach Garrett Looney, has built a reputation for turning games into pure offensive theater. 60 points and 500 yards of offense in 48 minutes of football have not been out of the question. But on November 14th, in a Class 5A second-round game against Eagle Crest at Highlands Ranch Stadium, Looney's move-at-will machine found itself stuck in neutral for the first time all season. Thankfully for the seventh-year coach, Vista's defense was there to throw the offense a lifeline. The number 3 Golden Eagles held number 14 Eagle Crest to 119 yards of total offense and forced a turnover en route to a 14-0 win and a spot in the round of 8, where they'll face 6th-seeded Arvada West. The quarterfinals have not been kind to the Golden Eagles of late. In 2023, the team lost badly to 14-time state champion Cherry Creek. Last year, they lost to Fairview in a wacky game. The stadium lights went out at halftime, forcing the two teams to load up on buses and make the 15-mile trip from Highlands Ranch Stadium to Echo Park Stadium in Parker to finish the bout there. So, are the quarterfinal ghosts swirling and ready to torment Vista once again? Or will this be the year the Golden Eagles achieve a program first and push through to the semifinals? Looney said the answer doesn't lie in the past. It can only be found in the present. This is a whole new group, so I don't really put much weight into what happened last year or the year before, just because we have so many new guys, he said. They're writing their own chapter. If their 2025 story is to include a chapter on beating 10-1 Arvada West Vista, 11-0, we'll want to put a choppy offensive performance against Eagle Crest, two uncharacteristic interceptions by Marquise Reese, and a lost fumble by Brody Callister in the rearview mirror quickly. Looney's squad entered the game averaging 47.8 points and 423 yards a tilt. Against the Raptors, 7-5, the Golden Eagles manufactured just 225 yards. Our offense just couldn't get into any kind of rhythm, Looney said. It seemed like whenever we made a play, we'd then commit a penalty to turn it over. We were just out of sync. While the offense may have sputtered, Looney will take what he got from his defense any day of the week. The Raptors only had two plays from scrimmage go for double-digit yardage, an 11-yard completion from William Brinkman to Jack Steiner, and a 10-yard Quincy Clayton reception. Eagle Crest running back Clyde Sorrell, who couldn't be stopped the week before against Legacy, three touchdowns and 181 yards on 23 carries, was held to 51 yards on 19 rushing attempts. Our offense couldn't really get it going, but our defense really stepped up, said Vista standout receiver and cornerback Brooklyn Bailey, who picked off a Brinkman pass as the first half was winding down. Of course, it wasn't all bad for the Golden Eagles offense. Despite tossing two interceptions, Reese, the state's second leading passer, had some good moments. Early in the second quarter, he hit Luke Bentley in stride down the right sideline for a 57-yard touchdown strike and a 7-0 lead. On Vista's opening drive of the second half, Reese threaded in a 38-yard pass to Sammy Brown, setting up Callister's 1-yard touchdown run two plays later to push the lead to 14-0. Reese finished 9-for-19, through the air for 128 yards. Hudson Modrzewski carried the ball 10 times for 51 yards to lead the Golden Eagles' rushing attack. Now Vista's attention turns to Arvada West of the 5A Metro League. I know they're big. I know they're senior heavy. I know they have a lot of good leaders on their team, Looney said of the Wildcats. They play in a tough league and they're well coached, so I know they're going to be good and present their own set of challenges for us. That's what the playoffs are all about. The following comes from the section entitled Local Voices, Love Never Fails. Winning Words by Michael Norton. Over the past few weeks, I've been writing about grace, truth, and forgiveness. This week, I want to bring those ideas home and anchor them in love. Most of us have heard these words before, love never fails. They're found in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, the same passage that reminds us that faith, hope, and love remain, but the greatest of these is love. If you've spent any time lately watching the news, scrolling social media, or listening to the latest debates, you've probably asked yourself a hard question. Where is the love? There's a saying that rules without love lead to rebellion, and looking around, it's hard not to see how far we've drifted from what our forefathers built this country upon. Love of God, love of country, love of neighbor, love of freedom. But love can't exist without forgiveness. The two are inseparable. When I write or speak about love and forgiveness, I elicit a range of reactions. Some people cheer, some laugh, while others roll their eyes, and that's okay. I'm not backing down, because what's happening in our world today, our growing divisions, our bitterness toward one another, is exactly what our real enemy wants. Division is always the first step toward destruction. But love disarms, love unites, love protects. I recently read a story about a politician who said that anyone who isn't far enough to one side doesn't deserve to live. I've heard similar things from the opposite end of the spectrum. We've lost sight of what truly matters. This isn't the North and the South anymore. We live and work side by side in the same neighborhoods, schools, and communities. We can't afford another war of words or of hearts. There's only one way forward, through love and forgiveness. Love never fails. Some may see this as a bold statement. Others might even call it controversial. But I've written more than 850 columns, and my message has always been the same. to help people grow stronger physically, mentally, and spiritually, to be peacemakers and difference makers in a world that desperately needs both. I owe much of that conviction to Zig Ziglar, who taught me that we're here to make a positive difference. The enemy will always look for cracks and crevices to divide us, but if we stand firm in love, if we truly believe that love never fails, we will outlast the storms. And here's the truth. Love isn't weak, sentimental, or naive. Love is the greatest force on earth because it requires courage. It takes strength to forgive, humility to listen, and patience to keep showing up when the world tells you to walk away. Love is what allows a parent to forgive a prodigal child, a friend to mend a broken relationship, and a community to rebuild after tragedy. It's not about being right. It's about being righteous. Love is our calling card. It's how people will know who we are and whose we are. And when we love like that, with grace, truth, and forgiveness at the center, nothing the enemy throws our way will prevail. So what does that look like in action? I mean, it means choosing kindness when it's inconvenient. It means listening before judging, helping before criticizing, and praying before posting. It's checking on your neighbor, reaching across the aisle, and giving grace where someone doesn't deserve it. It's letting love lead your words, your tone, and your choices, even when you're tired or frustrated. That's where real strength lives. Because when we love like that, consistently, intentionally, and unapologetically, hearts soften, hope returns, and healing begins. Love never fails. My hope is that you found this column helpful. And as always, whether you agree or disagree, I would love to hear your story at gotonorton@gmail.com. And when we live, work, think, and act in love, rather, it really will be a better than good life. Michael Norton is an author, a personal and professional coach, consultant, trainer, encourager, and motivator of individuals and businesses, working with organizations and associations across multiple industries. I want to go now to the Denver Voice and finish the series we began last week on free money. This article is entitled, "Free Money is the Solution to Homelessness." Denver City and County building is photographed in a beautiful sunny day. The lawn in front is beautiful green and half lit by sun. The leaves are trees are fully leafed. A Denver-based organization launches a nationwide basic income movement to address poverty and homelessness. Story by Ethan Clark. Whether you've experienced it yourself, known someone who's experienced it, or have just seen it in your day-to-day life, homelessness is one of the most prominent issues in the U.S. faces. In recent years, a new idea has gained popularity that has the potential to not only solve the root of homelessness, but could cost significantly less money per person than current programs. Basic income. Basic income programs directly give a specific population of people money each month to use on whatever they want. Unlike other assistance programs, which offer a lot less flexibility, experts say basic income programs promote agency and brand themselves as investing in the population. Denver is home to one of the more than 160 basic income programs across 33 states. According to the Maine Center for Economic Policy, since 2022, the Denver Basic Income Project has distributed more than $10.5 million to over 800 people who are homeless in Denver. While participants in the program say they provide immeasurable benefits, there is a concerted effort by some right-wing organizations to get rid of basic income altogether. This has put several programs, including DBIP, at risk of shutting down due to lack of funding. The important thing about direct cash is that it's a way of telling people that you trust them and they deserve the dignity and agency to make their own choices in their life that a lot of other forms of support or benefits don't grant them, said Gwen Battis, DBIP's project manager. How bad is the problem? Basic income is not a new idea, but it is one that has become more popular because of the rising cost of living and growing homelessness crisis. According to federal data, nearly 23 out of every 100,000 Americans face some sort of homelessness. In 2024, there were around 771,000 homeless people, increasing by about 18% since 2023. Senior citizens and families with children were two of the fastest growing demographics. However, it is far from exclusive to them. Using data from the DMHI in the Denver area, there were an estimated 10,774 people experiencing homelessness as of January 27th. Denver County had the majority of the homeless population at 7,327, and Jefferson County followed with 1,174. Broomfield and Douglas counties had the smallest homeless population in the metro area, with only 67 and 58 reported. What is the Denver Basic Income Program? Mark Donovan, a Denver-based entrepreneur and philanthropist, started the Denver Basic Income Program, DBIP, in 2020 with a full pilot launching in 2022 to find a new way to address the growing homelessness issue. According to the DBIP's website, the pilot was conducted by dividing people into three groups. Group A would be given monthly payments of $1,000 for 12 months. Group B would receive an initial payment of $6,500 and receive 11 monthly payments of $500. And Group C would receive monthly payments of $50 for 12 months. The results were overwhelmingly positive, with participants in all three groups having a higher rate of permanent residency and having more financial stability. Battis said the goal of DBIP was to give people cash with no strings attached, invest in people directly, demonstrate that direct cash can be a dignified and cost-effective tool to reduce poverty and specifically homelessness in Denver and beyond, and to change the narrative around what people are capable of when they're given stability, choice, and investment. There are two accompanying photographs on this page. The top one takes place outside the Colorado State Capitol. Women in blue branded t-shirts and a man. He's either putting one on or taking off an overcoat. But they're all smiling and they're just addressing a group of young people wearing backpacks, t-shirts, and jeans. The caption reads, Gwen Battis, center right, a project manager with the Denver Basic Income Project, speaking to a crowd at the rally for basic income in September 2023. Photo courtesy of Armando Geniero. Under that, there is a photograph of another young woman wearing the same blue t-shirt, and she is in front of a sign for the Denver Botanical Gardens, also explaining, her hands are out. She's in the middle of talking, explaining something to a group of people around her. Gwen Battis, a project manager with the Denver Basic Income Project, speaking at a DBIP event in the Denver Botanic Gardens with participants and stakeholders of the program discussing visions of the future in 2024. Photo by Armando Geniero. We continue the article. Seeing the success of this program, the Stanford Basic Income Lab launched similar programs in cities across the country. According to the results of these studies, most people use the money on retail sales and services, food and groceries, transportation, and housing expenses. Battis said that the Donovan started the program after seeing how the COVID-19 pandemic impacted homelessness in Denver, initially handing out cash directly from his own pocket and testing small-scale pilots before launching the program in full in October 2022, and final payments going out in September 2024. People spend money on exactly what you would expect, which is food, housing, transportation, getting your car repaired, paying off debt you've owed someone for a long time, and taking care of your kids, said Gwen Battis, DBIP's project manager. They don't do these things often, she added. There's a social and emotional piece that having extra cash grants you the ability to do things for yourself and take care of yourself. Battis also stated that the results from this program exceeded their expectations. For example, she said 45% of all participants are in a house or apartment of their own, and many reported significant improvements in financial stability and finding full-time work. Pushback against basic income. While programs like the DBIP show the benefits of basic income programs, attempts across the country to bring it to policy have been met with heavy pushback, especially among Republican politicians. In Houston, a program called the Harris County Prosperity Program was proposed to give 18 monthly payments of $500 to households within the zip codes with the highest poverty rate, but was struck down in a lawsuit from Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. State lawmakers described the program as, quote, lottery socialism, and claimed direct deposits to families were against the law. Another opponent to basic income is John Wick, W-I-I-K, a state senator from South Dakota, who believes these programs disincentivize work and claims the motives behind them are bureaucrats trying to hand out checks to make sure your party registration matches whoever signed the checks for the rest of your life. And that if you get people addicted to just getting a check from the government, it's going to be really hard to take that away. Other critics of basic income programs, especially those directed towards people experiencing homelessness, argue that it will be misused to buy drugs or alcohol rather than improving people's financial situation. According to Battis, that was not the case among participants in DBIP. There is no significant increase or decrease in spending on illegal substances or alcohol. It just remained the same, Battis stated. I think that it's a big misconception. All of these programs are showing the same results, that people are spending money on food, transportation, and housing above all else. That's not to say that people don't do that, because people who are housed do that. It's a bit of a narrative that we're trying to combat, that people in poverty or people experiencing homelessness are held to different standards, that they should and shouldn't be doing certain things with their time and their money. A new path forward. Another question up in the air about these programs is how integrated the government should be. Battis states that there are several ways it can be implemented. However, she believes that it helps to have a government element to the program, but I actually think some of the strongest examples of long-lasting and successful demonstrations of basic income are separate from government. That's not to say that policies should not be accepted or put forward. One successful example of a government-run basic income policy she mentioned is the Alaska Permanent Fund, founded in 1976 after oil was discovered in the newly admitted state. A fund was created by taxing revenue from the booming oil and gas industry so residents could benefit from the sudden increase in wealth. With an initial investment of $730,000, $4.2 million adjusted for inflation, the fund is now worth a staggering $83.2 billion today, money which is being used to help the people of Alaska. Battis believes a similar model could be implemented in other places across the country, such as Colorado. That's a really exciting and promising model that we looked at in Colorado that might work if we tax something like AI or robotics or digital advertising, she said. These models run off of our data, and we're not being compensated for all these tech companies becoming worth trillions. And that's not run by the government. I think there's a lot of different universal and targeted approaches that have been successful. And it really depends on the locality and what's happening in that area, Battis continued. Universal basic income does seem to work in Alaska, however. They have a very small population and vast quantities of natural resources. Would a program like this be realistic in states with larger populations and fewer natural resources, like Colorado? If every single resident of Colorado received $1,000 a month, it would cost the state roughly $72.2 billion per year. While this seems like a large number, a CNBC report on September 5th, 2025, stated that the 8 largest U.S.-based tech companies have a combined value of $21 trillion, which means that a universal basic income program in Colorado could be fully funded using only 0.3% of these 8 companies' wealth. That concludes the Denver Herald for the month of November. The Denver Voice for the month of November. We now go back to the Denver Herald Dispatch, back to Community Voices. Imagination, support, and courage will lead your dreams. Words of Encouragement by Jim Room. Friday, I was waiting at the airport for Beth to call and say that her plane from California had landed. To pass the time, I sat watching people. Two of those I saw were a mom and a daughter walking toward the door of the building associated with the cell phone waiting area. The two were holding hands as they crossed a sidewalk with a pattern of mostly gray triangles intersected by a stretch, maybe a foot wide, of red cement. When the girl, who was 6 or 7 years old, reached the red without skipping a beat, she leapt over that section. Whether to avoid a crack, to save our mother's back, or to see if we could truly make it across such a cavernous expanse, as children, we all made that exact same leap. As I sat and watched this tiny moment in time, I saw connections to our adult world, which I don't think I would have noticed before I started talking about encouragement. The little girl, whom I imagined because of the way she pointed her toes as she jumped, viewed that red strip of cement as part of a stage where she was performing. Perhaps she imagined being at the Met. More likely, she envisioned her dance studio's rented stage, or simply her studio classroom. She took a couple of graceful stutter steps as she approached the strip, and then, while holding on to her mother's hand, she catapulted herself across the expanse in a pretty ballerina jump, with legs stretched out in different directions and a lovely gentle motion with her free hand. The jump was perfect, and she happily continued inside with a quick glance and smile at her mom. In that moment, I was struck by the way the little girl used her imagination to envision herself exactly where she wanted to be. More than that, in her leap, I saw both great confidence and her never-wavering hold on her mom's hand, her support system, as she embarked on her endeavor. In that same instant, it occurred to me that many of our adult struggles can be overcome with the same things that the young girl used. Imagination to see things differently, a willingness to open ourselves to the support of loved ones, and the courage to try imagination, openness to support, and courage are a powerful transformative triumvirate. They are there waiting for you to use them in your struggles. You've got this. I hope my words encourage you and that you will share them with those who need support. Thank you to everyone who has shared their stories with me so far. I truly appreciate hearing about your valuable ideas and finding these columns and how you use them to uplift those around you. You can reach me at jim.roome@gmail.com. If you would like to see more of what I do, please follow Jim Room on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram under the title Voices We Miss. Jim Room lives in Arvada with his wife, Beth. He spent 34 years in public education, lessons learned from the 1-2 punch of being diagnosed with MS shortly before his best friend was diagnosed with terminal cancer, led him into a new pursuit as a freelance writer and a speaker. He uses his life experiences and love of stories to inspire, educate, and encourage local, national, and international audiences. Contact him at jim.room@gmail.com. The following is an advertisement to sell practical marketing solutions to local businesses. Sales territories currently available in various communities. Colorado Community Media, local first, Colorado always. Contact Nick Oliveri for more information. Nick@ColoradoCommunityMedia.com or 720-505-4635. In loving memory, place an obituary for your loved one, 303-566-4082, classifieds@ColoradoCommunityMedia.com. Self-placement available online at DenverHerald.net. That's all the time we have this week. Thank you for joining us for Denver Metro News, read by Matt.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.